Welcome back for the second hour of Issues Etc. Ahead, we've got an interview, just a snippet, I would say. It's a minute or two snippet of an interview on Good Morning America with Mel Gibson. He's out of rehab. He's been sober for a couple months, and we'll see what he has to say. He's trying to tell his side of the story in this exclusive interview about his recent embarrassment, his running with the law. And look, this is a let's approach it this way, and I want your reaction on the other side of what we play for you here during Audio Open Lines. Rather than worry about whether there's any a public apology or anything like that going on, I think he's done that profusely right close to the time of his arrest. This is a man, a famous mega celebrity. I think it's fair to say that Mel Gibson is a mega celebrity in his own right, who is a professing Christian. Rare indeed. Not just a professing Christian, oh yeah, I'm a Christian, blah, 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 but this is a man who holds to what some would consider a rather arcane form of Christianity. He's a rock-ribbed Roman Catholic. He's unapologetic about what he believes. He even made a big, high-grossing movie to display exactly what he believes, the Passion of the Christ, and he did it over the objections of many. Then he has a run-in with the law and major public embarrassment. What's your reaction to this? I want you to listen to what he has to say. It's just a little piece of a longer interview, and the second part is yet to come. But I want your reaction to it, just your general reaction to Mel Gibson's explanation or at least his description of what happened to him that night when he ran afoul of the law and then got himself in a little more trouble by things he had to say in the back of a police cruiser. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, it's Audio Open Lines, and we're coming to you live this Thursday, the 12th of October. Issue ZTC at KFUO.org. Open lines is always anything you want to talk about. So if a thought, a connected thought or an unconnected thought occurs to you, feel free to give us a call. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. And a little later, we'll hear from Bill O'Reilly's program on Fox News, where he had a short interview with Barry Lynn of Americans United for the Separation of Church and State. First, this comes from Good Morning America. They got an exclusive with Mel Gibson.
An actor and movie director finds himself front and center after an explosive public drama. Mel Gibson surrounded by questions about his lifelong battle with alcohol and anger, but also questions about anti-Semitism and the words that incited a fear and outrage earned by history. But before we can tackle some of those issues, none of us has ever heard what he says happened that night when police say a man going twice the legal speed limit with an open bottle of tequila in his car and a blood alcohol level half again over the legal limit was arrested. We interviewed Mel Gibson at his office, and as of today, he is 2.5 months sober. By the way, no questions were off limits. July 28th.
Yes, a day to remember.
How did that day start?
Much like any other day, I went to work, you know, saw a bunch of people. Had a screening, met with a friend of mine. He screened his film for me.
And then what?
Well, of course, I guess I must have been a little overwrought. So that's what happens, too much pressure, too much work. You do things that go against good judgment. So that's it. A few drinks later, and I was in the back of a police car wailing. So.
A few drinks later, do you know how many?
No, I don't. But I know it was tequila.
How long had you been drinking again?
A couple months. Years go by, you're fine. And then all of a sudden, in a heartbeat, in an instant, on an impulse, somebody shoves a glass of mezcal in front of your nose and says, "It's from Oaxaca." And you go, "Whop!" And it's burning its way through your esophagus, and you go, "Oh man, what did I do that for? Can't put the toothpaste back in the tube."
Were you drinking from the open bottle of tequila in the car?
I had a couple of slugs, yeah.
So how drunk were you?
It's not a question of how drunk you are or you're impaired. Your judgment is impaired enough to do insane things like try and drive at high speeds. Even a couple of drinks, you lose all humility. Everything is just, you become a braggart and a blowhard.
All right, that's the bit of the interview that was released by Good Morning America. Mel Gibson, I guess you could say, simply telling his side of the story. So we have a very famous celebrity who is a professed Christian and who has run afoul of the law and also garnered a pretty big amount of public embarrassment for the things that he allegedly said to the police. I want your take on Mel Gibson's, what he had to say there. Your simple reaction. That's all I'm asking for. 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. And aside from your own personal reaction, how should Christians react to Mel Gibson's situation? We know how the Jewish community has reacted. We know how the Hollywood watchers have reacted. We know how the news media has reacted. How should Christians react to Mel Gibson? He's one of our own. And he's not only famous, but he is now, at least at this point in history, to some degree, equally infamous. What should you say if someone walks up to you and says, I know about you Christians, you're the Mel Gibson types, aren't you? It's Audio Open Lines this Thursday, October the 12th. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address issues etc@kfuo.org. I have to mention this because it just occurs to me. I'm getting ready to go to work today. My wife was sitting in the living room watching television. And she was just spinning through the channels, and I'm downstairs, and I hear her say something like, "This is just amazing." Now, my wife very seldom reacts to anything by saying it's just amazing, so my interest peaked. I crept up the stairs to see what she was watching on television. She was watching Jim Baker. Does anyone remember Jim Baker? Jim Baker of he's still a televangelist too, of televangelist fame. I guess he's got a show, and it must be on TBN or one of those Angel Network or something like that. And I come upstairs, and Jim Baker is just, I don't know, he's probably 60 now. He looks like he's 60. He is just crying his eyes out. I'm not joking. It's not the polite, manly tear being dashed away in a moment of sadness. He is bawling like a baby. And my wife, who found this amusing, is watching this. I wander on into the kitchen to get myself a cup of coffee, and she's still saying, "This is just amazing. He's been crying for at least 2 minutes straight." And meanwhile, of course, there's someone singing in the background, some sort of gospel medley. And he's crying and crying and crying. And then on cue, just as the music comes to an end, he dries his eyes and puts on his reading glasses and starts asking for money. Now, we all watched Jim Baker when he was caught in, I think it was an adulterous indiscretion, which led to the discovery of all sorts of financial improprieties. And he cried, and his wife cried, and everybody cried on television. And then they didn't do much explanation. Their ministry went under, and I think their theme park went under, and all those kind of things. Now he's back on television. Got a show again, and he's still crying. With a new wife? Is that his new wife? Ah, that's who this woman was. I was looking at her, trying to figure out who she was. You could talk about any other famous Christians, not just televangelists, but we also remember, who's the one that said, "I have sinned," and he was caught with the prostitute in the car? I can't remember. Yeah, that was Jimmy Swaggart. Similar kind of a crying thing. Public confession, and then kind of under the radar for a while until he comes back up, and he's got a show again. And he's singing, which is really what he does best. He should stick to the singing and not to the preaching so much, because he's a better singer than he is a preacher. So prominent Christians fall publicly. Mel Gibson is among them now. I want to hear from you. What's your reaction to Mel Gibson coming out after 2 months of rehab and sobriety, ready to talk about what happened that night when he fell publicly for people all the world to see? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We have an in-studio email address. It's issuesetc@kfuo.org. LCMS World Relief is working diligently with its really doing its best to cover very difficult situations, not only here in the United States, where the need from Hurricane Katrina goes on for years and years, also far afield, whether it's the Sudan or whether it's Pakistan. We talked about Pakistan yesterday. For more information about what LCMS World Relief is doing on all of these fronts, you can go to our website, issuesetc.org, find their logo at our homepage. And when you give them a call, 1-888-930-4438, 1-888-930-4438, you can earmark your donation to any of their efforts anywhere they're at work. It's LCMS World Relief. Sunday night on the program, by the way, we're going to be at... Where are we going to be? We're going to be at Luther Chapel in Shorewood, Wisconsin, and we're going to be talking to Dr. Leonard Payton. It's been a long time. We're going to be talking to him about praise and worship music. That's Sunday night from 10 to 11 on 91.5 FM here in St. Louis. Monday, our Issues Etc. Reformation Tour continues when we broadcast live from Concordia University in Wisconsin. This will be our second visit to Concordia University, Wisconsin. We'll be talking about Luther on preaching with Dr. Pat Ferry, Dr. John Seleska on equipping the priesthood of all believers. The doctrine of justification will be the subject for our pastor's roundtable that we always have, Milwaukee area pastors this time. And then Dr. Nathan Jastrom will speak to us about the book of Job and God's mercy, and Angus Manoj. We can't go to Concordia University, Wisconsin without pulling Angus Manoj out of the classroom for a moment. And he's going to talk to us about defending the Christian faith. That's Monday on Issues Etc. as we broadcast live from Concordia University in Wisconsin. Let's go to the phones, talk with you, starting with Dennis, who calls from his car. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, Pastor Todd. How are you today?
I'm doing good.
Well, I have a question for you. Is this a situation in which we apply Matthew 18, where since the brother is repenting, that we then therefore need to forgive him?
That's a good question. I don't know, Dennis. I haven't thought about that in a while. Thank you for the question. Okay, remember when we talked about Gibson before, right after it happened? Someone called us and said, this is a Christian brother. We don't know for sure exactly what happened. We only know what the police reports are and what the media reports. We should follow Matthew 18 and not talk about it. I remember someone calling to that effect. It was one caller among several others when we were just reacting to the Gibson story. They said, we shouldn't be talking about it at all. Those who are, this is for Gibson and his priest, or Gibson and those in his immediate circle to deal with privately, according to Matthew 18. But we're very far past that because, of course, he's admitted to what he's done, and he's presumably paid his debt to society when it comes to the arrest and gone through his rehab. Now he's out just talking about that night and what happened. I don't know if it were a confession of sins where he's seeking absolution from fellow Christians, then certainly, yes, absolution ought to be forthcoming. But I don't know that this is a confession of sins rather than reflection upon what he did. He certainly asked for forgiveness from the Jewish community in general. He's asked for forgiveness from other people. We don't know. He may have asked forgiveness from the from his priest and ask forgiveness from the police officer that he offended. It's a good question, though, Dennis. Let's see what Chuck has to say. He's calling from South County. Hi, Chuck.
Hi. How are you?
I'm doing good.
Good. I don't know. I think I forgive him. I'm a Christian, and my wife and I, we first got married. I was a pretty heavy drinker, and I mean, I wish I could take back all the things I said and did to people, but I can't. And, you know, I'm ask God to forgive me and ask the people who I goofed up with to forgive me. And if they don't, you know, if they do, that's great. Because, I mean, I didn't, you know, I really apologize for things I said and did when I was drunk. And when you're drunk, you really say and do things you don't really mean to do. But, I think they ought to, you know, Christians ought to forgive them. Give them a chance, you know, what the heck. I mean, I don't know. Like, you know, I guess like the old saying is, if you mess me up once, shame on you. You mess me up twice, shame on me. But I'd be willing to give him another chance. I always did like Mel Gibson, though. I think he's a pretty nice, especially that movie he came out with. I really like that movie. But
all right, Chuck, thank you. Okay, so generally speaking here, give him another chance. Now, here we're talking about a prominent celebrity who is... he's got his own reasons for coming out and talking to Good Morning America. We don't know what they are. What about the rest of you? How do you react to Mel Gibson now coming out and talking about his run-in with the law and his public embarrassment? And how should Christians react to it, if at all? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. You can also email us, anxious to hear from those who listen on the Internet or who only have access to us via the email, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Ann's up next, calling from Crestwood. Hi, Ann.
Hi. Hi, Todd. I think the first thing I thought of was that power and money are so corrupting, and I would pray that my children never have a whole lot of either of those. And the other thing, too, with Mel Gibson, with his fame and everything, what kind of like-minded people is he surrounded with, and how many yes-men are he surrounded with? I would think there'd be very few like-minded people in his group that would keep him from going this way. I think it's an extremely tough road for someone like him.
Oh, so you're kind of saying perhaps it's very lonely to be a principled and professed Christian in the line of work that he occupies.
He's just way too famous, way too well known. I think there's just way too many yes men and party people around him. I just think it's to have an addiction anyway and be in his position. Oh, how does he keep his head above water?
Well, golly, Ann, thank you very much. I mean, suddenly I have a new wave of sympathy for Mel Gibson. It's not that I didn't have sympathy for him before, but you're right. With all the money, and he's beyond rich, with all the fame, and he's beyond famous, and with the privilege that comes with that, comes the amount of self-control even a non-Christian celebrity has to be able to exercise to stay out of trouble is amazing, because if they want to get in trouble, they can, and if they want to get in trouble, they know that they can usually get out of it, too. I guess I hadn't thought about that. You know, how difficult it must be. What does the Bible say? With great riches comes many sorrows, and like arrows that pierce through your soul. And many people have been run in by those arrows. Vonda writes this: unfortunately for Mel Gibson, humility appears to be not to be part of his apology. I watched the interview this morning, and while he was stating facts, I didn't see remorse. Just, this is what happened when one drinks. Mr. Gibson has a disadvantage because he's an actor, and it's a difficult thing to convince others that you're not putting on a show. That's right. Plus, he always seems to be rather an arrogant person. That is, this is what I believe, take it or leave it. I don't think that's arrogance. That's, I mean, at least in my book, that's conviction, which used to be a virtue. I really enjoy Mr. Gibson's movies, with a few exceptions. I look forward to what future projects will be and how this will impact his career. I'll be very interested to see the completion of the interview tomorrow. Thank you, Vonda. Thank you very much. Okay, yeah, I got to admit, when I'm watching Gibson talk with Diane Sawyer, I'm thinking to myself, this guy is either a great actor or he's the most sincere person in the world, and maybe a little bit of both. I don't know. He's a good actor. We're talking about Mel Gibson's interview with Good Morning America. The first part ran today. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org, and our call-in numbers, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Time permits, we'll get to Bill O'Reilly's interview with Barry Lynn of Americans United for the Separation of Church and State. Karen Malik joins us on the other side of the upcoming break. We're going to talk about, since October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, we're going to talk about the link between abortion and breast cancer. In the third hour of the program, Uwe Simonetto joins us here in Studio A. We'll see what he thinks about the media coverage of North Korea's nuclear test. And then, the last half hour, you get to pick your favorite anti-amendment to public service announcement. We're going to play four more, just like we have the last 2 days. We're going to play four more, and you get to choose which you think is the most effective to the person who remains undecided on Amendment 2 in Missouri. That's coming up in the last half hour of Issues, Etc. Well, the Reverend Barry Lynn says that the Christian right poses a real danger to America. He's got a new book in which he makes those very statements. Here he is with Bill O'Reilly on Fox News.
In the Culture War segment tonight, a traditionalist like me feels that secular progressives are a danger to the country. But, to be fair, on the other side, the SPs say the Christian right is the real problem. Joining us now from Washington, Reverend Barry Lynn, the author of the brand new book, Piety and Politics, The Right-Wing Assault on Religious Freedom. You know, and I disagree on this, so I we're not going to ever solve our disagreement. We just see the country in a different way, which is why the country's great. You have your opinion, I have my opinion.
Absolutely.
I want to ask you a few very simple questions to set your book up. And I recommend the book, by the way. I think everybody should get a wide variety of opinion before forming their own. Do you know any elected politicians who would you would consider a Christian rightist, a fanatical person bent on imposing their religious point of view on others? Do you know any?
Well, I certainly knew, for example, the Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court, Roy Moore, who's the guy who put that 2.5-ton granite monument of the Ten Commandments
right in the judicial center. But the system took care of him, and he wasn't elected. He was appointed.
No, he was actually elected. But I think that there are people who have been serving in the United States Senate both in the past, like Senator Jesse Helms, and today, like Senator Cornyn, who are very close in ideology to the James Dobsons, the Jerry Falwells, the
Pat Robertsons.
All right,
now, Cornyn is interesting because I quote him extensively in Culture Warrior, my book on the Christmas controversy. Now, you believe that Senator John Cornyn wants to impose Christianity on other Americans?
I think he wants to go so far that we get to a theocracy light. And the main point of my book is to say, look, we don't have to get as bad as the Taliban in this country in order to say we're on the wrong track. When you mention secular progressives, the best kind of government, in my view, is a secular progressive government. Why? It's secular because the government never takes over or acts like it can resolve theological matters or take on the role of religion. And it's progressive because of progress. The great strength of our country, Bill, as you know, is that we try to expand opportunities. We try to also expand civil rights and civil liberties. That's the essence of a good government.
It depends where the progress leads.
All right, before we go on with that one, we're going to have to take a break here. So we will, and I'll have some thoughts here on the other side of the break. I am a big advocate of the separation of church and state. I think it protects the church. I think it does. I know that runs counter to a lot of the way Christians think. I don't think, at least to this point, most of the time, our government, such as it is, oversteps the bounds of a good separation and distinction between church and state. Everybody is in favor of separation of church and state. It's only a matter of degree. Don't tell me you're not. Do you want the government to pay pastors salaries and tell them what they can preach? Well, then you're in favor of the separation of church and state. Are you in favor of, say, like in Islamic countries, pastors being able to declare holy war and gather a militia and go out into the streets and fight their battles? Well, then, by golly, you're in favor of separation of church and state. It's a matter of degree. What we're arguing over is to what degree and in what way are church and state separated. Now, I happen to believe that Barry Lynn, while he has many good ideas, hard to name any right now, gives the separation of church and state generally a bad name. Because, according to the way he presents it, I don't know if this is how he actually thinks, but the way he presents it, the only people who could legitimately express their viewpoints, their moral viewpoints, in society are atheists and agnostics. At least that's what it sounds like to me. That he wants religion to be an entirely private matter, rather than a private and public matter with its public aspects carefully delineated by that distinction between the separation of church and state. We'll be right back here the rest of that interview.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Coming up on our Bible study programs, on Friday we will ask the pastor. Our friend from Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Collinsville, Pastor Michael Walder, will be our guest. And then on Monday we're back into the book of Ephesians. We'll take the first 16 verses of chapter 4 with Pastor Nathan Metter of Zion Lutheran Church in Staunton. The Bible study, weekday mornings, 10:05.
The Bible study on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Concordia Christian Books and Gifts, serving God's people.
Here's an AM 850 KFUO salute to our day sponsor on this Thursday, October 12th, 2006, Robin Groner. Today's day sponsor has made a contribution to AM 850 KFUO in appreciation of Pastor Douglas Balder and his faithful service as pastor at St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Wildwood, Missouri. Once again, a very special thank you
to Robin Groner of St. Louis, today's AM 850 KFUO Day Sponsor.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Kim Troby, sitting in for Bob Dittmer. The U.S. Supreme Court will not hear the Doe v. Bolton appeal. Doe is the companion ruling to Roe v. Wade that broadened the definition of medical exceptions for abortion, making abortion on demand the law of the land. Pro-life groups are disappointed but not surprised, since the High Court refused to hear a similar appeal in the Roe v. Wade case several years ago. Pete Wynn reports.
In 1973, the Doe ruling was made based on assumptions. Now, 33 years later, Linda Schlieder with the Justice Foundation says we've wised up to the harm the procedure does to women.
This is not an assumption or in theory as what the court had before it in 1973. It is now a real-life experience.
The Supreme Court is reticent to rule against 33 years of precedent, and many in the pro-life camp are not surprised they didn't take on such a monumental case up front. But Daniel McConkie with Americans United for Life says we shouldn't give up.
What's most likely to happen is at some point down the road, when we have the right number, you know, people on the court, that the court will take some sort of regulation and reconsider then the grounds on which Roe and the right to abortion stands.
He says the court has backed itself into a corner when it comes to abortion, and it will be difficult for them to get out.
The court really has to get to a point where they get rid of the fact that they should be standing as the ultimate medical board on this issue and return it back to the states so that state legislatures and us working through them and the state medical boards can get involved and work out something that the people within each state find to be equitable for their population.
In order for that to be accomplished, the court will have to rule on smaller abortion cases to build precedent. For Family News in Focus, I'm Pete Wynn.
The High Court has only been in session a few days and already turned down several high-profile cases. For Family News in Focus, I'm Kim Troby.
As you plan your end-of-year charitable giving, please consider making a contribution to Worldwide KFUO. And one of the most rewarding ways to support us is to become one of our day sponsors this fall. In fact, many open dates remain available during October, November, and December. Claim a day, commemorate an occasion or person, and keep KFUO moving forward, upward, and onward. For more information, visit our website and click the support link at kfuo.org. Or contact Jeff Craigmeyer at AM850 KFUO.
It is true that the doctrine of the Trinity is something of a mystery, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't teach it to our young children. Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October is titled The Apostles' Creed. For more information, call Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040 or visit our website, issuesetc.org. The Apostles' Creed costs $9.99 plus shipping and handling. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org. The Apostles' Creed.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're going to finish up this bit from Bill O'Reilly's program where he interviewed Barry Lynn about his new book. Barry Lynn, of course, from Americans United for the Separation of Church and State, which is, by the way, I'll hand this to Barry Lynn, one of the most brilliant titles for an organization ever. So subtly brilliant, Americans United for the Separation of Church and State. That's smart. That's smart. Barry Lynn, as I said before the break, presents a version of the separation of church and state wherein, at least to my hearing of what he has to say, unless you're an atheist or an agnostic, you really shouldn't have anything to say about moral issues in society. And that gives the separation of church and state a bad name. That's what most Christians are railing against when they say, we reject the separation of church and state. Because if they stopped for a minute and thought about what they were saying, they wouldn't say such foolish things. They wouldn't say, we reject separation of church and state, or I don't believe in the separation of church and state, because they do. It's like gun control. Do you want criminals to carry guns? No, you don't. Then you believe in gun control, just to a different degree than someone else. All right? Do you want your dog to have a machine gun strapped to his back and run down the street? No. Then you believe in gun control. Same thing with separation of church and state. When a Christian says, and we really should keep ourselves honest, when they say, I don't believe in the separation of church and state, make them say what it is they really mean, because they don't mean that. Believe me. Here's the rest of Barry Lynn with Bill O'Reilly.
If the progress is undisciplined, and if the progress goes into areas that tear up the fabric of the country, then it isn't good. You know, progress for the sake of progress isn't good.
No, but
you
what,
get a car, you can get a car that can go 300 miles an hour and you're dead within a week because you can't control the car. But you brought up the a centerpiece of your book is the gay marriage debate, which you feel somehow shows the intolerance of the Christian right. The gay marriage thing.
Now, absolutely.
Just today, the Supreme Court, once again, the Supreme Court said, look, we are not going to intervene in the gay marriage debate. We're not going to. We're going to allow the states to decide what kind of a structure they want to license vis-a-vis marriage. Now, that seems to me that our system is working. It's not a theocracy. They're basically kicking it back to the locals, and they're saying, you decide which unions you would like to license.
Okay, how about this? Let's kick it back to the locals at another level. That is individuals who are making choices based often on their own theological views about what marriage is. You know, up until 1967...
They have a right to do that, though.
Well, up to 1967...
It's one man, one vote. And you can vote for whatever you want based on whatever you want. You shouldn't be running these people down because they don't like it.
No, but Bill, look, I don't worry about running them down. What I worry about is the fact that the Christian right will not understand that some people are making these moral commitments to have one man marry another one man. It's the same way as in the past, as I said, you used to find
no black people
could marry white people. That was the law, Bill.
But the Supreme Court isn't buying the constitutional argument. They're not buying it. And you can make a decision that you would like to see heterosexual marriage have a special place because it's a societal stabilizer, which is what the argument is. I'll give you the last word on it. That's ridiculous.
It's not a stabilizer. 50% of heterosexual marriages are falling apart. I've been married for 36 years.
The
two guys up the street get married. It's not going to affect my marriage at all. It won't affect yours either. There's no negative impact. If we just allow people to make their own moral judgments,
they made their moral judgments. They made the judgments in every state, even the SP states of Oregon and California, and they've said no. Check out the Reverend's book.
All right, that's from Bill O'Reilly. This is a couple of thoughts here. Did you hear in the last? He knew the time was running out, so he started marshaling all of his arguments when it comes to gay marriage. He threw out at least three of the standard boilerplate arguments in favor of gay marriage. Barry Lynn did. Now, Barry, let's examine what's behind. He says the religious right is imposing its view on society. But isn't he imposing his religious view of gay marriage, that is, God doesn't oppose gay marriage, on the rest of us too? He claims to come from a neutral position. I guess that's my biggest gripe with Barry Lynn or the proponents of gay marriage in general on that issue, is they claim to come at this from a completely neutral position when their position is anything but neutral. The opponents of gay marriage do not claim to come at it from a neutral position. Let's all be honest with one another and say none of us are neutral. None of us are coming at it from a neutral position. Actually, the most neutral position would be don't change anything. The status quo, which even in itself is not neutral. He rejects the idea that marriage is a stabilizing factor in society. I don't know. Barry Lynn is a smart guy, but he has to know that lawmakers in the courts have recognized that marriage is an important factor in society, legally. That's why there are laws pertaining to marriage. It's not an issue of personal piety. Now, you notice what he wanted to do. He wanted to turn marriage into a purely private, personal issue of piety, which people decide on their own. The problem is marriage leaks out of people's individual lives into society. It's also a social institution. Are there people who have theological views for supporting gay marriage, as bogus as I consider them to be? Of course. But that doesn't make their position right. He seems to be asserting that if someone thinks they're acting in a moral way, they are. But that's nonsense. Unless you were willing to concede, and maybe he is, I don't know. Unless you're willing to concede that morality itself is purely personal and private, and that there is no transcendent right or wrong. I suspect that might be what is lurking behind Barry Lynn's thoughts. And if that's taken to its logical conclusion, you cannot function as a society. you can't legislate anything. Anything. You can't legislate against child abuse, sexual assault, murder, rape, incest, anything. Stealing, larceny. You can't even really legislate against or in respect to the separation of church and state. If all right and wrong is purely personal, private, and subjective to the individual. Joining us for the rest of this segment, Karen Malik is our guest. October, of course, is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. And what is often not in the public's awareness is the connection between abortion and breast cancer. Karen Malik is Executive Director of the Coalition on Abortion Breast Cancer based in Palos Heights, Illinois. Karen, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Karen, are there more breast cancer victims now than there were before the legalization of abortion under Roe v. Wade?
Oh, absolutely. In 1970, 1 in 12 women developed breast cancer. And today, 1 in 7 women develop breast cancer. So it's gone up considerably. And today, we expect, for this year, we expect nearly 275,000 total cases of breast cancer. I'm talking about both the invasive and the in situ breast cancers. And normally, when other cancer groups are talking about the number of cancer cases, breast cancer cases that we have, they're just talking about the invasive. Okay.
How do those cancer groups, many of whom refuse to acknowledge the link between abortion and breast cancer, or actually argue against the link between abortion and breast cancer, how do they account for this steep rise in the incidence of breast cancer since legalized abortion?
Well, they don't account for it. They keep telling women they don't know why there's been an increase. They keep saying that we need to find a cure, but defining cure is, it's very elusive because, let me give an example. In 1990, I was diagnosed with colon cancer, and I have not had a recurrence of colon cancer. Now, if I get a recurrence, let's say I get 20 years from now, I get a recurrence of colon cancer, does that mean I've been cured? You see what I'm saying? They can cure you of cancers in the sense that you don't get it again for maybe 10, 20 years. So cure, the definition of cure is very, very elusive. The problem that I have is they're not telling women the truth about this research. We have overwhelming evidence of an abortion breast cancer link. We have statistical evidence showing a statistical relationship. More women who have abortions go on to develop breast cancer. We have 70 studies that have been done since 1957. 80% of them report risk increases for women who've had abortions. They're not telling women that there are two breast cancer risks of abortion. Only one of the two is debated. The other one is recognized. And you can go to any cancer website, cancer fundraising group's website, and you can see that they tell women that childbearing is protective. It reduces risk considerably. And, in fact, the single most important thing a woman can do is to have an early first full-term pregnancy. And they define early as before age 24. And they also say that breastfeeding protects women against breast cancer. You cannot breastfeed a dead baby, okay, a baby that's been aborted. You cannot do it. And so they're not telling women about that particular connection to breast cancer cases or to abortion. In fact, the American Cancer Society admits on its website that much of the increased incidence of breast cancer is due to the change in our childbearing practices. For example, and they say this, for example, We're having smaller families. More women are having no children at all, and also lack of breastfeeding, and abortion has a big key part in that. Now, going back to what I was saying earlier, we do have epidemiological research to support this debated link, and we also have biological evidence, overwhelming biological evidence. We know estrogen is the culprit in the development of most breast cancers. In fact, the World Health Organization has already admitted and recognized that combined oral contraceptives, which contain estrogen and progestin in them, progestin is a synthetic form of progesterone, these are carcinogenic to humans. They classified them as group 1 carcinogens along with combined hormone replacement therapy. And this supports an abortion breast cancer link because it's also about a woman being overexposed to estrogen in the presence of progesterone. It makes the breast tissue grow, and the estrogen itself can initiate cancers and damage the DNA. So they're not telling women the truth about this, and I would say also they did not tell women the truth about the fact that the hormone replacement therapy, the combined hormone replacement therapy, and the oral contraceptives contain the exact same drugs, yet women were warned about taking combined hormone replacement therapy and not warned about the oral contraceptives. And the combined oral contraceptives have more of these drugs in them. They have a higher dose than the combined hormone replacement therapy has in it. And also, I would add that the other research that supports an abortion breast cancer link is animal research, and also we have a sound biological explanation for this link between abortion and breast cancer.
Let's talk about that. Let's talk about the biological explanation, and insofar as you can, in as with as much layman terminology as possible, explain in simple terms what the biological connection between what happens in and after an abortion is with the later occurrence, or making it a contributing factor to the later occurrence of breast cancer.
Okay, well, it is very simple. It's not rocket science. It's a very simple explanation. As I said, they know that estrogen's a culprit in the development of most breast cancers. Only about 10% of them are due to the BRCA gene, you know, genetic a gene that was a bad gene that was inherited, and about 90% of them are, the other 90% of them are due to an interplay between the hormone estrogen, which is a known carcinogen, and breast tissue maturity, the maturity of the woman's breast tissue. And what happens is at puberty, estrogen rises at puberty. It increases, and this is what causes the breast to grow. And at this time in a woman's life, the estrogen stimulates the breast lobules to develop into a system of very immature lobules. Okay, these are very immature, cancer-vulnerable lobules called type 1 and 2 lobules. So this is what the young woman has when she's childless. All women have these cancer-vulnerable lobules. And it's in these type 1 and 2 lobules where 90 to 95% of all breast cancers develop. They know this. They know this much, and they admit this much. And during a normal pregnancy now, the breasts grow because estrogen again stimulates those lobules to start multiplying. So the woman gets more cancer-vulnerable type 1 and 2 lobules. This growth is taking place in the first two trimesters of pregnancy. if she's carrying a normal pregnancy. Now, I'm not talking about most miscarriages, because in most miscarriages, their first trimester miscarriages, and the woman's not overexposed to hormones, and her breasts don't grow. But during the first two trimesters, her breasts grow. She gets more type 1 and 2 lobules. Then in the third trimester, starting at 32 weeks of pregnancy, there's another process that kicks in, and it shuts off that multiplication process. It stops the growth of the breast tissue, and it starts maturing this breast tissue into cancer-resistant type 3 lobules. And then at the end of pregnancy, the lobules fill up with milk, and now we call these lobules type 4 lobules, and they are also resistant to cancer. So the woman then that goes on to breastfeed, the longer she breastfeeds, the longer her lobules are matured into cancer-resistant type 4 lobules, and the fewer menstrual periods she has, because menstruation is suspended during her while she is breastfeeding, and when she has when she is breastfeeding, then she is exposed to less estrogen because she's not having those menstrual cycles. You see, with every menstrual cycle, the woman is overexposed to estrogen and just before she ovulates. And however, all right, the woman who has that full-term pregnancy now has more cancer-resistant tissue than she had before she became pregnant. That's how childbearing reduces risk and it protects the woman from breast cancer. The woman who has an abortion, however, went through that breast lobule multiplication process. She went through the growth process where her breasts enlarged, and she got more type 1 and 2 lobules, the cancer-vulnerable type lobules, but she missed out on the third trimester process that would have protected her from breast cancer and matured her breast tissue into cancer-resistant tissue.
So she's more vulnerable.
Yeah.
She's more vulnerable than a woman who never has a child.
Right, because she is left now with more of those type 1 and 2 lobules, the cancer-vulnerable lobules, where scientists say the overwhelming majority of breast cancers develop. So she now has more places for cancer to start in her breasts.
And now, just to pause at this moment, this, in a nutshell, is not only the link between abortion and breast cancer, but the explanation to our first part of our conversation, why after millions of women, American women in particular here, we're talking about that context, after Roe have exercised their so-called constitutional right to free abortion, legalized abortion, why we have more victims of breast cancer today than 33 years ago.
Right. Well, I would add also that the woman that has a premature birth before 32 weeks of pregnancy, she's in the same position as the woman who's had an abortion. She has gone through that multiplication process where she gets more of the type 1 and 2 breast lobules, the cancer vulnerable lobules, and she misses out on that third trimester process that would have protected her from estrogen and matured her breast tissue into cancer-resistant tissue.
Do the cancer groups recognize that? Do they recognize that a premature delivery is a contributing factor?
To breast cancer risk, they have not come out and said that, because biologically, the premature birth is biologically the same event as having an abortion. Only the mother's intention differs, you see. But we do have epidemiological research supporting this evidence. We have statistical evidence showing a correlation between having a premature birth before 32 weeks of pregnancy and a more than double breast cancer risk. Now, here's the kink that gets thrown into this. We have 60 out of 60 studies now that have linked premature birth with having had a previous abortion. So in other words, abortion not only raises a woman's breast cancer risk, but it also leaves her more susceptible to having a subsequent pregnancy that where the child is prematurely born. And we have a large body of research that supports this, and it goes back to 1963. Women were not told about it. In fact, Malcolm Potts, who's a former medical director of IPPF, International Planned Parenthood Federation, he admitted it in 1967 in the journal Eugenic Review. Eugenics Review was the name of it. And in 1976, the Hungarian government recognized a link between having an abortion and then a subsequent premature birth. They restricted abortion in their country after they recognized that there was a link there. The March of Dimes has paid for some of the research that has been done. In 1980 and 87, there was research done. The Institute of Medicine this year acknowledged this link in a paper that they put out on July 13th. It's on the web for anybody that wants to look at it. It's on page 519. The Institute of Medicine is an organization of the National Academies of Science, and they also recognize other risk factors, well-known risk factors, for premature birth, which an abortion can cause, infection and cervical damage.
Karen Malik is executive director of the Coalition on Abortion Breast Cancer based in Palos Heights, Illinois. October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. The website address for the Coalition for Abortion Breast Cancer is abortionbreastcancer.com. It's all one word, abortionbreastcancer.com. It's the website for the Coalition for Abortion Breast Cancer. Karen, thank you very much for being our guest.
Thank you. I was delighted to be with you.
Not only, I mean, the cure, the search for the cure is a great thing. We should all be supporting it, but let's also talk about whether or not we can mitigate the cause or the contributing factors at the same time and be willing to honestly admit what those causes and contributing factors may be. When we come back from this break, we've got hour three of Issues Etc. straight ahead. Uwe Simonetto joins us here in Studio A. We'll see what he makes of the media coverage of North Korea's nuclear test. He's still wondering whether the thing actually occurred. And, of course, the media has been all over it, among other things. Uwe is an international journalist. He'll join us right after this break. And then we've got four more of the Anti-Amendment 2 ads to play for you in the last half hour. This is what we've been doing, if you're just catching on, for the last 2 days and then a day next week. What we're going to be doing is playing a group of Anti-Amendment 2 ads and asking you the simple question, which is the most effective in communicating the truth about Amendment 2 to those who are undecided about that issue? That's coming up in the last half hour of Issues Etc.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.